All right. Good morning. Please be seated. This morning, our first case is State versus Manuel Garcia. And I'll ask counsel to make their appearances, but first I want to note that Justice Hagedorn is not participating in this case, so his absence is for that reason. But we do have Ann Walsh Bradley appearing in the case by phone. So if you start hearing someone on the phone asking questions, kind of stop a little bit so she can get her questions in, and we'll try to make sure she has ample time to do that. Okay, with that, please, could you make your appearances? All right. Excellent. Thank you. Good morning. All right, then, we'll first proceed. Counsel, you're up.
Good morning, and may it please the court. As I said, I am Assistant Attorney General John Blimling, here today on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. The Court of Appeals made a significant error in this case. It ruled that the impeachment exception to the exclusionary rule is the only way that a defendant's previously excluded inculpatory statement may be admitted at trial. That holding is not only legally wrong, but it will have consequences. By allowing defendants to deliberately mislead juries, exploit blank spots in the record, the Court of Appeals holding diminishes the search for the truth and the fundamental fairness that lies at the heart of all criminal trials. Therefore, the state asks this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision and hold that a defendant's cross-examination of a state's witness can open the door to the defendant's previously excluded voluntary statements, and that is what occurred in this case. I want to begin with the legal principles that underline what we're talking about here. The Court of Appeals described the issue in this case as being whether the impeachment exception could be used to impeach a witness for the state and bring in a defendant's previously excluded statements. To be clear, the state never requested that. The state never requested to impeach its own witness. The reason the state asked to bring in Mr. Garcia's previously excluded statements was because Mr. Garcia's cross-examination of Investigator Spiegelhoff opened the door to the use of those statements. It's a completely different line of cases. It's a completely different set of principles. But it does apply in the Fifth Amendment context. We see that from cases like State versus Brecht, which is a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, and United States versus Robinson, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case. Looking first at Brecht, this court held, this is a 1988 case, this court concluded that it was not constitutional error for the state to elicit an officer's testimony, a state's witness testimony, about the defendant's pre-Miranda silence after the defendant opened the door to that by asking if he had said that it was all a big mistake. Essentially, the defense created the impression that it was never given the opportunity to explain to police what actually had occurred in that case.
Mr. Blumming, let me ask you a question since you're going through the cases. In Brecht, of course, it was about the defendant did not make a statement. It was a comment on his silence. Is there any authority that you know of for what you're asking us to do here, which is to introduce the statement that was made that is not comment on the silence?
So there is no case that the state has found that deals directly with that question, and that goes both ways. No court that I found ever held that a statement could come in, but no court that I found either ever dealt with the situation and found that the statement was fundamentally different than silence and therefore could not come in. It's sort of an open question.
And let me just, if I might just ask a follow-up to that. So then, as I read your briefs, What it seems to me you are asking us to do is to apply the case law equally to both statements and silence. Is that what you're asking us to do?
I think that's a fair characterization of the state's position, yes.
Thank you.
I'm going to follow up on that, counsel. You do cite to some cases, right? And I think Brecht is included in this, but the cases from other jurisdictions that you cite to, but they all involve a contention that the defendant made involving his post-arrest behavior. And the state witness was allowed to respond to that. What is the contention here that you say this defense made?
So, Justice Dowd, that question gets into sort of the second part of the analysis, just to be clear. if this court holds that a defendant can open the door, then the next question for this court to address is whether he did in this case.
And also the law surrounding when that door can be opened, right? I mean, I think we could probably all conceive of a situation where a defendant potentially could open the door.
Sure.
The question is what has to happen? And I look at these cases that you cited, and it appears that first of all, none of them let in a statement. But to the extent they let in information that was previously kept out, there was a direct contention about the defendant concerning his post-arrest behavior, a falsity, a perjury, something that needed to be responded to, not an impression, not questioning about an investigation. So can you speak to that, please?
Sure. So I think the best formulation, and again, there's no case directly on point that I can say, here's the formulation of what needs to happen. I think the best formulation of that I found is in the Illinois case, People versus Payne. That is actually a Fourth Amendment case, but it's relevant because of this discussion about statements versus silence and whether something obtained can still be introduced versus just this sort of contentions about the silence. In People versus Payne, the Illinois Supreme Court talked about, find the exact wording here, but it has to do with creating a clear and unmistakable impression or clear and unmistakable misimpression. And so there's not going to be, it's going to be context dependent, I guess is the answer. It's going to depend on what the nature of the prosecution is, what the nature of the defense is, and what the nature of the excluded evidence, the excluded statement is.
Okay, so here, how is talking about all the days leading up to a death, which would be something that anyone would want to talk about, how is that leading this unmistakable misimpression? And what is the misimpression of exactly?
The misimpression is of the police officers, Investigator Spiegelhoff's decision not to investigate the laundromat specifically. So there were sort of three incidents that occurred before the victim died in this case that have been discussed throughout the case. There is the child falling down a set of stairs, there is the child jumping out of the bed of a truck, and then there is the child falling out of a laundry basket at a laundromat. The timing on how this information came to light sort of explains what happened here. So the victim died in the early morning hours, I think it was March 12th, and police were at the hospital at roughly 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that. They then went back to Luanda Martinez's home with Manuel Garcia, I think it was actually Garcia's home, and talked about some matters. At that time, they learned about the stairs and they learned about the bed of the truck. Police took pictures of those things. Following that, Investigator Spiegelhoff spoke with the medical examiner and learned that those falls almost certainly would not have caused the type of injuries that the victim suffered in this case. That it had to be a more direct force, a strike, a punch, a kick, something like that. So they arrest Garcia, they question him, they get his inculpatory statements. At about that same time, they find out about the laundromat. But they decide not to go to the laundromat because it's the same sort of character of fall that is the stairs and the bed of the truck. combined with the fact that Garcia has now admitted to punching the victim several times, no further investigation is necessary. So the misimpression that the defense cross-examination created is that this laundromat incident was sort of on equal footing with the truck, with the stairs, and that somehow the police just decided not to look into that. And that's not really what happened in this case. There were intervening factors that led to the police not investigating that, Mr. Garcia's confession, and that's why I didn't look at that. Now, if you look at the transcripts from the whole trial, you'll actually see defense counsel setting the stage for this as early as his opening statement. Record 77, and I've got it at page 24 on record 77. Counsel says, "The state obviously has its position, its theory, in terms of what happened. But what I also want you to keep in mind during the trial is what didn't happen once it was known that this child had fallen out of the laundry basket. You heard about that, and you'll hear more about that later. But I want you to keep in mind what did not occur, what didn't happen on the part of the police department, what didn't happen in terms of investigation to that matter. That is also significant." So even before this questioning starts coming up with Investigator Spiegelhoff on the stand, defense counsel is already setting the stage for an argument that the laundromat was somehow different than the other incidents, and that failure should call into question the entire police investigation.
Or was it the trial court too far? In other words, why didn't the trial court just say, when counsel asked that the door is open, why didn't the trial court just say, well, you know, why don't you just recall your expert and get him to testify that the injury the child had the fall out of the laundry cart, if that's his view, or something like that. The medical expert, because that's what everybody had to rely on.
So there are a couple points I'd like to make in response to that, Justice Rogenczak. The first is that this is sort of the third part of the analysis in this case. The first part is whether the law allows the opening of the door. The second part is whether the defendant did in fact open the door. And then the third part is whether the response was appropriate. As to whether the response was appropriate, what I would say is it sort of divides into two things here. There's a fine distinction between whether the injuries sustained at the laundromat, or any potential injuries sustained at the laundromat, could have caused these injuries, and the defense attack on the investigation. The defense attack on the investigation has nothing to do with whether the child could have sustained those injuries at the laundromat. It sort of implies it, but it's actually kind of taking a different approach to the defense there, in that it's attacking what the police did. It's implying that they may have missed something, that, you know, something may have been overlooked.
Implying that the police missed something in regard to the source of the child's injury.
Sure, but again, the response to that is not, I guess, a fair response to that is not, well, it doesn't matter if the police missed something because they wouldn't have actually missed anything anyway, right? It doesn't matter if the police did a poor job. Okay.
But I am concerned that playing a half-hour video and putting in a statement that's suppressed on constitutional grounds, and no one's arguing that it was not correctly done, was that really a fair response if the door were open here? To just get by that step, the door is open.
Right.
Is that a fair response? And That's what concerns me.
Sure.
Seems a lot to me.
Sure. And I understand that. I think, again, this is a question that's going to vary from case to case based on the context and what came in. Again, I would go back to People versus Payne. In that situation, there was a handgun found, I think, in the vegetable drawer of a refrigerator. That's something that comes in very quickly. But it's also highly prejudicial in that case. So I think the real question is less about what is specifically coming in and more about how it's being used. The law, and this is really this, you find this in Brecht, you find this, I think, mostly in Robinson. The law is that if the door has been opened, the fair response, the fair use of that material, whatever it is, has to do with correcting the misimpression. So it's not that the door is opened and now the state can use this as substantive evidence of guilt. The state can't do that. It has to respond to correct the misimpression. And that's what happened here.
Can you tell us what the misimpression was? They didn't investigate the laundromat any more than they said they did. Why is that a misimpression? What is the falsity or a perjury or sword that Miranda has become in this context? I'm missing that piece.
Again, I think the misimpression, the best description of the misimpression I can give is that the police simply failed without reason.
Counsel, can I try to maybe see if I'm understanding what I believe is the answer to
Please.
That question, as you stated before? The defense was going after, there's this third theory of how this child received these horrible injuries. And the third theory deals with falling at the laundromat, right?
Yes.
But it's not limited to falling at the laundromat is what caused the injuries. The defense theory was shoddy police work, didn't follow up on something as simple as that. The whole investigation is bad, and you can't rely on the police work done here. So it's really attacking the entirety of the investigation, not just this one fall. Is that correct?
I think yes. I think that's a fair way of describing it.
Let me ask you this. Did the medical examiner have the laundromat information in the medical examiner's report?
No.
So had the state introduced the medical examiner's testimony and had the medical examiner testify about something that was previously not in the report, would that create perhaps a whole host of different issues as to discovery and lack thereof, or appellate issues on things that weren't previously brought up?
It certainly well may, and I also think that it would not be directly responding to the misimpression that was created.
Well, it might respond to part of it, but it wouldn't respond to why the investigators didn't do other things.
Certainly.
Right? So it would leave that whole other theory left to the impression that the investigation's shoddy. They didn't follow up on something as simple as this laundromat incident, right?
That's right.
And at the same time, open the door to appellate questions about whether or not you can even go into alternative theories of how this child may have been injured, because that was something this medical examiner really didn't take a look at, correct?
Certainly may, yes.
And it definitely wasn't discoverable.
Correct.
So the court is left with the situation of trying to figure out, assuming that this is something allowable in the law, which I think the law clearly establishes, did the defendant open the door to a response being appropriate? And then if a response is appropriate, what did the court have at its – what could the court do? What were the court's options? Because I'm not convinced recalling a medical expert to have them testify about something totally outside the record is the answer. So what could the court do? What other things? Because then we get into trial court response, discretionary level of scrutiny on appeal, and whether this was so outside the norm that it is clearly erroneous. So I think part of what you're hearing is people being stuck on that.
I think that's right. I think that's a very apt description of kind of what the issue is here. And I think that this is probably the stickiest part of this case, is what actually should come in. I would say that, in many appellate contexts, appellate courts rely on circuit courts to make factual determinations, to weigh things like whether the line of questioning was in fact creating a misimpression or, you know, that whole sort of thing. We also rely on circuit courts to formulate remedies in a lot of cases, whether that's, you know, a question that's objected to and the remedy is a simple jury instruction instructing the jury to disregard or something more than that. A lot of that stuff falls within the purview of what we traditionally allow circuit courts to do. So, you know, in terms of like standard of review, how are we looking at this? I do think that there is probably some deference owed to the circuit court on how it actually formulated the remedy. And yes, I mean, there was discussion you asked about recalling the medical examiner. You know, I was also wondering about, well, do you let Investigator Spiegelhoff sort of summarize what Garcia told him rather than playing the entire video? I don't know if that is better or worse. You know, I think now you have this sort of state's witness summary of here's what I heard, when in fact we have the recording and you can show that to the jury so they know exactly what happened.
Recalling the medical examiner, though, would only be part of the answer, right?
Correct.
The court would still be left with how do you deal with the entire investigation being shoddy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what do you think? Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I thought you were done.
I was just trying to figure out what other evidence, other than maybe a summary of the statement and what happened, as to why law enforcement didn't go further, versus playing the actual piece of evidence, why one is necessarily or automatically better. It could be worse.
But I agree. I agree. And that's why I think it makes sense to leave that decision to the discretion of the circuit court.
All right. So what is a defense attorney supposed to do then? They're not allowed to ask questions to insinuate that an investigation was shoddy? I mean, isn't this, I've seen a lot of trials, I've been a prosecutor in many trials, that is a common theme. So how is the defense attorney now supposed to adequately represent their client when there's a suppressed statement? They have to be careful, they can't ask about what the police did to investigate, and by the way, in response to direct examination where this witness was specifically asked, did you follow up and investigate this laundry cart incident? No, I did not. Why? Because based on what the doctor told me, it couldn't be involved in the injury. I mean, that's what happened immediately prior to this. You got that out there, that the doctor said it couldn't be related to first, I guess I'm asking lots of questions. First, you got that out there about the doctor. Call the doctor. Ask more questions about the doctor. He clearly gave an opinion about what could and couldn't have caused it. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, what is a defense attorney supposed to do when they hear these questions in direct, and what is their, when their whole line of defense is that it could have been all these other things that you and I both know maybe it wasn't, or maybe the testimony of the doctor would have been that it wasn't. What are they to do?
So it would have been completely proper, and it would not have opened the door, I think, for the defense to argue that something happened at the laundromat that caused the child's injuries and caused his death. In the examination, the cross-examination of LaWanda Martinez, the victim's mother, there is reference to the fact that the defense attorney had an investigator go to the laundromat, took pictures of the laundry basket. Those were presented into evidence. It's exhibits 23 and 24, trial. So that information is in there. If they want to argue that he could have sustained these injuries falling out of the laundry basket, they can argue that he could have sustained these injuries falling out of the laundry basket. I don't think it's going to be a successful defense, but they can argue that. But when they start taking advantage of the fact of exclusion of his inculpatory statements, that's when it crosses the line into opening the door. And that's something that they simply can't do. And this kind of goes back to the nature of the exclusionary rule, the nature of Miranda. These are prophylactic rules designed to combat police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, things of that nature. And so I think there's also implicit in that is, what were the police supposed to do?
Well, right, but let me throw one more thing in there. Let's say that, I guess you're treating two things as mutually exclusive. You're saying that when someone confesses, the police are supposed to drop everything and not continue investigating. What if this was, the statement was even in evidence? Wouldn't it be still a line of defense that the defense would have to still say, well, what could have been this? It could have been that. So what if he confessed to punching him on this day? It could have been all these other injuries. Isn't that a line of defense anyway? I'm not understanding why it's a misrepresentation or why this theory still wouldn't have been in play even if the confession was in evidence.
So First of all, I'm not arguing that the police should just stop when they get a confession. I think obviously sometimes police good police work will dictate that the police need to continue investigating. But I don't think that the police investigation was shoddy is in and of itself a fair line of defense when I don't think the police investigation was shoddy. You're saying that if the defense is saying that the police investigation was shoddy because they didn't even investigate the laundromat, but they didn't investigate the laundromat because of Garcia's confession, you can't separate those two from one another. So if the defense wants to argue that the police investigation was shoddy, it can do so, but it has to do so with the full context.
Counsel, I sense that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley might want to ask a question. Is that accurate?
That certainly is. Oh, you have your foreseeability hat on, I think. Thank you. I want to go something more specific, and that is, what is the issue in this case, and what is the law? In your brief, you present a single issue, and the issue, as stated in your brief at the outset, is did the Court of Appeals err, and then I will skip. Given that, now I'm going to quote the last part of your issue presented. The admission of the statement was permissible under the opening the door doctrine elucidated by this court in Brett. And yet, at the gate, at the very beginning of this oral argument, you were asked by Justice Karofsky, is there any authority for statements introduced rather than the silence, which is through Brett? And your answer was, I found no court addressed this issue. So, what is the issue here? Is your issue statement advancing that the law as it currently exists indicates that the opening the door exception exists in this fact situation, or are you saying it should exist?
Thank you, Justice Bradley. I want to note for you that my red light is on, so I'm going to briefly answer your question now.
Yes, you should.
And I might come back to this in rebuttal. But in short, I would say there is no binding case law on this. But what I would say is that the state is not asking for an expansion of the opening the door exception or the opening the door principle. I would say that if you look at opening the door cases, and related case law, I would say that this situation already falls within, although it has not yet occurred specifically.
That sounds like doublespeak to me. Is there any case that you can cite to, counsel? And I don't mean to respond with such enthusiasm, so let me be a little less enthusiastic. But I understand there is no case that you can cite to for this circumstance. You can analogize to Brecht, you can talk about Robinson, but there's no, which dealt with silence, but there's no case that you can cite to. So it seems to me you're really advancing. It should be an exception, or rather a doctrine that this court adopts under these circumstances. Rather than, perhaps you can further that on rebuttal rather than protracting this. I would appreciate that.
And then we really are going to conclude, but I'll afford her a little leniency on a brief response.
Thank you. And Justice Bradley, yes, that is correct. There is no case specifically on point here. So if if that is saying that the case or that the principle should apply to this, I think that's fair. I would also say that they do apply here. So,
okay. Thank you, counsel. All right. Ms. Jewell?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Emma Jewell from Godfrey & Kahn. With me at counsel's table is Sean Bosak. We represent the defendant appellant, Manuel Garcia. There's a few points that I'd like to make before responding to some of the state's arguments. And the first is that it's important in this case to take a step back and look at the big picture. This is a case about the Miranda exclusionary rule. That rule is an established element of the constitutional protection against self-incrimination that is enshrined in both the United States Constitution and the Wisconsin Constitution. That rule and the protection it affords criminal defendants is at stake in this case. The trial court concluded that Mr. Garcia's statements were obtained in violation of Miranda. It therefore excluded them from trial, and that's something no one is challenging in this case.
Are you aware of any cases where excluded statements have been used in response to a defendant opening the door to their inclusion at trial, either in the state's case in chief or in rebuttal?
I'm not aware of any controlling authority where that's occurred.
Okay.
So at trial, however, the court...
Let me just follow up a little bit. Do you think that ever can occur?
No, I do not. I think
so. No matter what the defense does, no matter what they do, that is always and absolutely precluded in both the case in chief and in rebuttal.
In this case, we're talking about the state's case in chief. And the United States Supreme Court and this court have held that excluded statements are inadmissible in the state's case in chief.
Okay. So are you asking us to adopt a rule that this is always inadmissible in a case in chief?
We're asking this court to uphold the binding precedent that already holds excluded statements are inadmissible in the state's case in chief.
Okay. But no further. You're not saying they're always excluded, and you're just saying in the case in chief. I'm just trying to figure out exactly what you're asking this court to conclude and what the rule is that comes out. So give me, in your words, the rule that comes out of this case.
A defendant's excluded statements are inadmissible in the state's case in chief, and the United States Supreme Court has carved out circumstance by which a defendant can open the door to use of those statements, and that is the defendant's taking the stand and testifying inconsistently with the excluded evidence. That is the impeachment exception, and that is the circumstance by which a defendant can open the door.
So it's only when the defendant takes the stand, testifies, and these come in, perhaps in rebuttal?
Yes.
So they could come in rebuttal if that happened?
Yes, under established precedent. And the United States Supreme Court has rejected use of a defendant's statements beyond that. In James v. Illinois, which was a case dealing with the Miranda exclusionary rule and an exception, considered whether the prosecution could introduce excluded statements in response to a defense witness testimony. And the United States Supreme Court rejected that because it would chill defendants' ability to present their best case, and it would undermine the deterrent purpose of the exclusionary rule. Now, what the state's asking this court to do here is to create a brand new exception to the Miranda exclusionary rule that is not only inconsistent with the purpose of the exclusionary rule, but would have damaging consequences on the rights of criminal defendants going forward. And the reason is because it would create a no-win scenario for defendants. In cases where evidence is suppressed, defendants would be faced with two options, both of which are bad, both of which infringe on their constitutional rights. On the one hand, they could pursue cross-examination of the state's witness, and that could potentially risk the admission of excluded evidence. On the other hand, they could avoid that cross-examination altogether, but that option infringes on their constitutional right to present a complete defense. So in either circumstance, it's the state that's benefiting from having that unconstitutionally obtained evidence, and it's the defendant whose constitutional rights are being infringed.
Ms. Jewell, let me ask you just a follow-up to just what Justice Ziegler was asking. What I'm hearing you say is that these statements can never come in a case in chief. They can come in as impeachment, but only in rebuttal. What about a situation where a defense attorney introduces misleading evidence that could only be contradicted through a suppressed statement? I think Walder was one example in the briefs, but I'll just give you another one. Defense attorney gets up in opening argument and says that this defendant, use this case, Mr. Garcia, never laid a hand on a child. And we know that even according to Mr. Garcia's statement that he either hit the child or spanked the child, depending on which statement he was giving. But that is, it would be a 100% false statement. My client never laid an unkind hand on a child.
Yes, and that's a situation of extreme attorney misconduct, violating not only professional rules, but giving the judge the option to declare a mistrial, hold the attorney in contempt of court. The response is not to admit unconstitutionally obtained.
Okay, so I'm clear, and I think Justice Ziegler drew this out, you are drawing a hard and fast line that these statements, that line is not to be crossed. Once these statements are suppressed, other than for impeachment and only impeachment, they may not ever be introduced.
Yes, Your Honor, and it's not me drawing the hard line. The United States Supreme Court has drawn that line, and that line has been followed for decades. So, yes.
So, I'm just going to, if I may just follow up. In the state's brief, the state says, meaning Garcia, cites no case holding that the impeachment exception is the sole exception to the exclusionary rule for un-Mirandized statements. No such case exists. What's your position on that statement?
Well, while we have not quoted language using the phrase only exception, it's not surprising to us that the United States Supreme Court or this court have not said that, because the rule is that unconstitutionally obtained evidence is excluded. And the United States Supreme Court, in all its time, has carved out a narrow exception to that rule, and that is the impeachment exception.
But, counsel, these are all judge-made exceptions, right? Why can't this court recognize an exception that furthers the policy goal? Because Miranda, I think we all acknowledge, is totally based on policy. There's nothing like that in the Constitution. So what is there to prevent this court from recognizing an exception based on the circuit court's concern that the jury would be terribly misled if defense counsel, during closing argument, had highlighted the fact that, well, this child had suffered these other accidents that could have caused death, and that was not pursued by law enforcement, and the prosecutor at that point could not say, well, they didn't pursue it because they had a confession in hand. They couldn't do that during closing argument, right?
What we're talking about here is absolutely proper, and the trial court concluded this, absolutely proper cross-examination of a state's witness. And if that becomes a standard by which the state could introduce excluded evidence, then, like I explained, a defendant has two options, both of which are going to violate their constitutional rights.
But my question goes to the argument that could have been made in closing had the circuit court ruled differently in this case. What is the prosecutor supposed to do in order to correct the misperception that would have been created by defense counsel had defense counsel pursued that argument?
And had defense counsel pursued that argument in closing, the judge actually concluded as well that that would be proper argument by defense counsel. And it's important for us to remember that we cannot misconstrue effective advocacy for something that's improper. It's the state's burden to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. And defendants are entitled to create doubt. They're entitled to challenge the state's case and the sufficiency of the evidence.
But the truth would suffer because the jury would not, under those circumstances, be able to hear law enforcement's explanation for why it did not pursue these other possible causes of death, because they knew what had happened. There had been a confession.
Well, in this case, the jury heard the explanation from the investigator, which was that after he spoke to the medical examiner and based on what she said about the timing of these injuries having occurred, I think, 8 to 12 hours before the child's death, that's why he did not go and follow up on the laundromat incident. So the jury already heard that explanation. There was no correction that was needed here, and there was nothing misleading by defense counsel. And I want to touch on a point that relates to a question Justice Rogensack asked earlier, which is, could the state have called the pathologist to testify? And at trial, as this was happening, the investigator testified. The state then moved to admit the suppressed statements, and the judge took that motion under advisement. The state then proceeded to conduct redirect examination of the investigator, asking him, you know, did the timing of the injuries affect your investigation? Yes. And after that, the pathologist testified. Now, all of this occurred prior to the admission of the excluded evidence.
But did the pathologist testify specifically that the kinds of injury the child suffered would not have occurred simply falling out of a laundry cart? I didn't see that.
And I can't quote specifically what happened. The pathologist did say that, you know, she wouldn't be directing an investigation. She was just providing the medical testimony and what her conclusions were.
To me, what bothers me most is whether this was a fair response as to opposing counsel. And I understand you want a bright line and that's the end of it and you can never open the door, and I get all that. It's a good argument. But what bothers me most, was this a fair response, or did the trial court misuse its discretion by doing what it didn't need to do to clear up the, quote, misimpression? And I didn't see the state's witness testifying in detail about how the injuries that the child had, you need a forensic pathologist to do it, would not have been caused by falling out of a laundry cart. I mean, so I just didn't see that in the record. And if I'm wrong, and I'll go back and my law clerk and I will look at the testimony again, but I didn't see that. And to me, that was troubling. You know, I've only sat on the Court of Appeals in here, though I was in the trial court a lot. It was always on the other side of the bench. And it just seemed to me the trial court went too far here, that you could have said, well, I'll permit you to either recall or call the forensic pathologist and see if we can clear this up without getting into the statement that's been suppressed. And to me, that seemed to be a better choice for this case, but maybe I didn't read everything in the record that would have said exactly the same thing. I don't think a law enforcement person can explain medical testimony. I think you need a medical doctor to say what you see and what could cause that and what could not have caused that.
Well, the state's argument has been that the defendant was, you know, giving the impression that the investigation was shoddy. And let's be clear, that was never argued because, again, we're talking about the state's case. Defense didn't even get a chance to present their case at this point. But the issue related to the investigation and what the investigator followed up on.
Right.
And that really doesn't have anything to do with the medical testimony. It has to do with his decision-making, which was explained already on direct examination prior to Mr. Garcia's cross-examination.
So you're saying that his examination, his investigation, my understanding is his investigation was foreshortened and he didn't seek further evidence about the injuries that could have come from the fall of the cart because Garcia had already confessed.
Well, that question was first asked to him on direct examination by the state. And the prosecutor asked him, why didn't you present that incident? And he said it was because of his conversation with the medical examiner and the pathologist relating to the injuries. That was his explanation out there for the jury on direct examination.
But just because he says that doesn't make it so. There wasn't testimony from a medical doctor about whether falling from the cart could have caused the injuries that killed the child. Right?
Again, like I said, I can't quote the exact portions of the record at this point.
Okay. I'll go look at it some more, but thank you.
He couldn't have said, could he, have said, I didn't pursue that further because we already had his confession?
No, he could not have. And I think what people are getting hung up on here is the fact that there might be a gap in the state's case, there might be a hole there. That is the expected consequence of the exclusionary rule. And to allow the state to introduce that excluded evidence to patch up that hole or say, no doubt here, that eviscerates the exclusionary rule altogether.
But what I hear you saying in response to Justice Rogenczak was really the attack wasn't on whether medically the injuries to this 26-month-old child could have occurred from falling at the laundromat. Really, the attack was on the fact that the officer didn't do more. So on the investigation, and you're saying the officer is the one to answer that.
That is what the state's argument has been as to what was, quote, misleading. And let's be clear, our position is that nothing was misleading there, but that is what the state has put forward as the questioning that supposedly opened the door. And our argument is that there was nothing misleading there, and even if there was no correction that needed to be made because the explanation was already before the jury.
What was the explanation before the jury as to the shoddy investigation?
The investigator testified that his decisions were based on his conversation with the medical examiner and the timing of the injuries and when they occurred.
But the truth is, his decisions were based upon that and the fact that he had a confession from this defendant that he did this to this child. I mean, there were two reasons. So he was precluded from going into the real reasons, right? There were two reasons, but he could only testify about one because of the suppression of the evidence regarding the confession.
I'm not in a position to judge subjectively the investigator's decision-making. And so,
but could he have said, I did it because of the confession and my discussion with the medical examination person who said these, you know, falling out of a truck, falling downstairs, and probably falling at a laundromat, even though they didn't get to the laundromat, that wasn't going to cause these injuries to this 26-month-old.
No, he could not have said that. But like I said before, that is because the evidence was unconstitutionally obtained and excluded.
Right, but the questioning led the jury to think, huh, this guy stopped short. He just went after one person.
That was the impression that the jury was left with, that maybe there was an inadequate investigation done as to all the leads that potentially could have caused the injuries. There's nothing wrong with that because that is defense counsel effectively advocating And sometimes criminal defendants, their only line of defense is to challenge the state's investigation or the sufficiency of the investigation. So doing that is not improper.
Right. I don't disagree with you, and sometimes they are inadequate, right? Having said that, the difference lies when you leave the jury with an impression that there weren't any good reasons for stopping where they did. I mean, when you do that and the confession itself is the answer to why they stopped, among other things, the truth plays a role in what a jury should see too, right? I mean, they're to evaluate, hopefully, truthful testimony to reach a sound conclusion in the law. It's just this comes against the suppression of a statement. But when the suppression of a statement is later used as a sword, what would ever stop, what should stop defense counsel from pushing this issue in every case where a statement is suppressed? Because no one can ever hear that the person confessed, and that's why law enforcement stopped where they did.
The key, I think, in your question here, defense counsel never used any of the suppressed evidence as a sword. And so even if this court's going to consider creating the new exception that the state's asking for here, that questioning was not used as a sword. There was no reference to the excluded evidence. It is completely distinguishable from, other cases cited by the state referencing a defendant's silence. There was no questioning about Mr. Garcia's statements, interrogation, or his ability or inability to make statements.
So are you taking the position that the defense argument had nothing to do with this being a poor investigation? That wasn't a theory of defense to try to receive a not guilty verdict. Are you saying that was not their defense?
No, I'm not saying that. I also am not in the position to judge what the theory of defense was at the time that Mr. Garcia was being represented at trial.
How about the opening statement referencing failure to investigate
but
faulty investigation? I mean, it seems to lay out for the jury what the defense theory is, at least as of that point, and the trial hasn't even started.
But again, at that point, there's nothing improper about that. And as the trial judge concluded here, with respect to Mr. Garcia's cross-examination, and even the prospect that he could argue, which had not occurred at that point, but even the prospect of him arguing that in closing was proper. The trial judge recognized that. And so if we're going to allow the prosecution to introduce excluded evidence in response to proper argument by defense counsel, then there will not be anything left of the exclusionary rule. And the state is asking this court for a new exception. The state's not providing a constitutional basis for that. The state's not providing a standard for that. Nor is the state providing any limiting principle. Because what will happen now going forward is any time a defendant is cross-examining the state's witness about an investigation, or even more broadly, just challenging the credibility of the state's witness, pursuant to their Sixth Amendment right to do so, the state's going to be able to argue, we need to introduce the suppressed evidence to rehabilitate our witness and our case.
Depends what the questioning is. Right?
That would be the standard going forward. And as I explained, it would have disastrous consequences on the constitutional rights of defendants. Not only that, it would undermine the deterrent purpose the exclusionary serves. Because if just the mere possession of unconstitutionally obtained evidence allows the state to either deter defendants or introduce that evidence, the state benefits from just obtaining it. And that signals to law enforcement, it doesn't matter if you follow the Constitution when you're conducting an investigation, because either way, we're going to be able to use that evidence one way or another. And it's for these reasons that the United States Supreme Court in James v. Illinois rejected further attempts to expand the existing exception to the exclusionary rule. And the Eastern District of Wisconsin in Kuntz v. McCautry considered the possibility of whether the state could introduce suppressed statements to impeach its own witness. And the Eastern District concluded that could absolutely not be the case, because if the prosecution cannot introduce excluded evidence to impeach defense witnesses in the defendant's case, then they absolutely cannot introduce excluded evidence in the state's case. In conclusion, there is no precedent for the purported exception the state seeks. If this court adopts such an exception, it will jeopardize the constitutional rights of all defendants in cases where evidence is suppressed. And even if this court were to consider adopting such an exception, this is not the case to do so. If your honors have no further questions, I have no further argument today.
All right. Go ahead and step down. I was sort of waiting to see if Ms. Bradley had some, but apparently she does not. So,
no, I have no questions at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to begin where counsel ended, talking about Kuntz and impeachment of the state's witness. And again, just to point out, this is not an impeachment case. The state did not seek introduction of this evidence to impeach its witness. If it had, it may have actually done so in response to Investigator Spiegelhoff's answer about why he didn't further investigate the incident at the laundromat. As counsel pointed out, when that question came up, he said, my discussion with the medical examiner led me to believe that that sort of fall would not create those injuries. That's only half of his answer. And so if the state was seeking to impeach its own witness, it could then say, didn't you also have other information at that time? And the state, that would be the avenue where that would come up and where Kuntz might be relevant. But because that's not actually how it happened, I really don't think Kuntz is relevant to the analysis in this case.
So, counsel, if there's two reasons, the confession plus the medical testimony, you're telling us that the only way to make a fair response is for the entirety of the truth, which juries often don't hear, but the entirety of the truth to be put forth, that it's not enough that they had a response with the medical examination. They have to hear the whole story, which is both the confession and the medical exam.
I do think the extent of what a fair response will be is going to vary based on the context of the case.
I'm talking about this case.
And so in this case, I do think there should be significant deference given to the circuit court's determination that the entire confession coming in was the best and most proper way to correct for that.
And you agree, though, that by even suppressing the confession, as counsel referred to it, there's always a hole left. But you're saying that the jury's entitled to the entire story, everything, even where evidence is suppressed.
It gets to the purpose of the exclusionary rule, I think. Briefs in this case were filed in April, and I think in June this court released its decision in Birch, which had a discussion about the purpose of the exclusionary rule. That I found very relevant, having to do with misconduct, essentially. We're trying to stop misconduct. And it brings me back to the question of what else would the police have done in this case? So I don't know how such a rigid application of the exclusionary rule in this case actually deters anything. I do disagree with the argument that if the state has its way here, police are just going to stop Mirandizing suspects, get the confessions without Miranda, we'll get it in anyways. I really don't think that's going to be the case. You know, obviously I can't guarantee that, but I don't see why that would be the case. You know, best practices are best practices for a reason.
What's the remedy? Let's say we agree with you, the door's been open, and the statement should come in, but we find that too much has come in. What's the remedy?
If this court makes that holding, I do think it's going to be a reversal, to be honest with you. I considered early on in this case, when I first handled it 3 years ago, a harmless error argument, and I think the problem there that came up here is that it led to Garcia's decision to testify directly. And I don't think the state can get around that, and I'm not arguing for harmless error for that reason. He argued in the circuit court that the only reason that he chose to testify was because of the statements coming in. So if the statements coming in was error, or the extent to which they came in was error, and that led to his testimony, I do think a reversal and remand would be necessary.
What would it be remanded for?
A new trial. So I also wanted to touch on limiting principles. Counsel stated that the state has offered no limiting principles. That's not correct, or if that is correct, I will offer some now. The first is voluntariness. An involuntary statement is never going to come in under the opening the door inception because of issues surrounding the reliability of those statements. Again, the state is only talking about voluntary statements in this case. But also the state discussed the use of the statements, how those statements get used. And again, I see that my time has run, if I might
finish
very briefly.
Answer.
Here the state, there's about three pages when Investigator Spiegelhoff is recalled to the stand, and the questioning is solely limited to his decision not to continue the investigation. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, counsel. It was very interesting argument and good briefing on these issues. We'll have our work cut out for us later on today, but I hope you have a nice day. Thank you.